Hello, listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a journalism student, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. Some listeners have met Daniel Platts before. He plays bass for the Toronto metal band Discontinuity, but he's also an academic and an anarchist, pursuing a master's in social and political thought at York University, where he's recently applied to write his PhD. We caught up again to talk about political currents in the academy, life as a master's student, and the role of the public intellectual. Well, on the note of revolutionary cred, we started talking a little bit about politics in the episode that we did about discontinuity. But I understand that's a pretty big part of your life. How did you get into politics?
Well, I don't even know if I actually am in politics. Like,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I feel you. But like, I guess I've just like always thought about society, and I was interested in like history and things like that. But like, man, I don't know. I remember being told that like I liked politics a lot when I was a kid, just because I'd be like engaged in discussion when adults would talk about shit, and like maybe I was like, I don't know, I'd ask questions, I'd be like a shit disturber or something, and then people would be like, you're destined to be a politician or something like that. So it's like, I don't know, my parents also honestly just always like discussed the news and shit around me when I was little, so like I guess I had that like inroad.
Did you find yourself wanting to talk to the adults at the dinner table more often than the kids?
Eventually. For a long time, I cherished being able to just go fucking wild in the basement and just like run around and fucking like jump on couches and shit where the adults would like party upstairs. Like that, I loved the kids' room. It was amazing and like a place free of consequences in so many ways. But when I got old enough to like understand, like, I don't know. Well, I think like at the end of elementary school, that's probably when I like started to, I don't know, actually talk to adults instead of like, yeah.
What did you talk to them about when you started like really paying attention to those things?
At first it was really just me like taking up the family like creed of being a liberal, and then like it was Alberta, so there'd be a lot of conservatives who would like argue against like, I don't know, public services and things like that, and I'd give like a very standard kind of like neoliberal like, oh, but yeah, it's actually good to have taxes because collectively like our wealth can be better. But like from that earliness, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it's just, there's a lot of conservatives in Alberta that say like fairly dumb things. And it, like I would just like, yeah, talk to them about that. But eventually like my views morphed to be like much more anti-capitalist. And then like once I was a teenager, most of what I'd talk about would be like attempted anti-capitalist critiques of whatever like shit people were talking about. You know, it's hard to say though. It's like, yeah, it's not something I've ever thought about in like a structured way that way. Like my own.
Is there a particular moment that you can recall or anything like that when you found your views shifting from upholding the family tradition of liberalism to a little further down the spectrum?
I think in junior high, like I remember being taught about the left-right spectrum. Like, you know, like the left wing, right wing kind of like way of organizing political like systems. And I knew I was on the left because I knew I supported social programs. And I also knew that like social democracy as it worked in Nordic countries was amazing. But then like just like seeing it laid out and seeing like, oh, on the far end, we have communism, so spooky. And on the other far end, we have fascism, so spooky. I thought, wait a minute, if all the things I like politically are on the left, and the farthest left position you can go is communism, well, maybe I'll be really into that. And I also just love torrenting. And I think like experiencing that freedom of information and going like, wow, money is bullshit. It totally limits creativity. What the hell? We could just be literally sharing everything. We could do that with food. We could do that with knowledge. Like, and just seeing how detrimental things like copyright law or like, I don't know, like corporate interests buying politicians, like seeing how much those things limited things really started to push me. I don't know if I could pin it down to an exact moment, though.
Would you say during the time you were a teenager, approximately?
Yeah, like grade 8 to like grade 12, a continuous process of like radicalization and distancing from like just party politics.
So would you call yourself a radical then?
Yeah. I mean, I don't deserve to, because look at me. I'm so goddamn privileged. Like, I go to a protest every month or something and feel like I'm making a difference when I'm really just like living off a university stipend. Like, I don't know. I believe that my views are considered radical by a lot of people. And I believe in like a struggle against the state to achieve a better society. So in that sense, I am radical, but I don't know if I have the street cred that like my views like require.
Talk a little bit about what you're taking in university, because that's certainly, from what I understand of it, on the theory side of radicalism, or at least the interest you've expressed in the past. If not, you're not out there in the streets all the time, what are you doing at school?
Oh man, so I'm in a program called Social and Political Thought at York. It's like a very interdisciplinary program that was started in, I think, 1971, which is kind of like right after the collapse of that like libidinal liberation kind of like leftism, even though that's still around. But like, I don't know, it emerged in that like that Nixon-y sort of void of like the early 70s.
Did you say libidinal liberation? Can you explain that a little?
Oh, so there's like Stalinist communism, right? Which is based on very like modernist understandings of history and like unifying the productive forces to like, I don't know, overcome all limitation and make a utopian society. And then like after World War II, a lot of people went, uh-oh, this idea of just like unifying everything and like making the destiny of history, that's kind of fucked up. Maybe what we should be doing is freeing individuals. And because of Freud's like significant influence on critical theory and also just the kind of like psychological nature of capitalism and even its limiting of actual political programs, people turned to the idea of libido and how different political regimes like limited libido or channeled it for their own ends. And then like it wasn't obviously the most persuasive doctrine, but like you can see it in like the general like social anti-war movements and even the civil rights movement, although that one wasn't like quite as hippie-ish. But like, yeah, it's the idea is just liberate the libido of the individual and make it so that people are kind of like able to live their own desire without the infringement of some kind of totalitarian industrial apparatus.
What do you mean exactly by libido?
Like desire, will, your emotions, your kind of, for lack of a better word, almost your essence, like you're unconscious, like those forces that drive you that aren't really under your conscious control.
Right.
Yeah. Your energy, like, yeah, it's really just like a physical kind of thing. And I'm not fully for just like the liberation of libido. I think it's like it's a useful like thing to aspire to, but I don't know how much it works for actually dismantling systems of oppression.
You're saying what is your program is?
Yeah, social and political thought. Yeah, and it came like in the wake of kind of the failure of like Paris 68 and like moments like that. Like it basically just as capitalism was like integrating this like sexual revolution kind of leftism. It just said, oh, cool, dude, go to a mall. It'll get you off every time you look in a store window. It'll be amazing. Your libido will be so liberated. You have all these desires you can chase. And like, it just gobbled up any revolutionary potential and put it in itself. It's why you can have like a Pepsi commercial where like Kylie Jenner, you know, like comes up to the protesters and gives them a fucking bottle of sugar water, right? Like... So like the aesthetic kind of revolution is so bankrupt, and it's also still very much like in vogue in the academy. I find people are very convinced of like the emancipatory power of poetry, or like the idea that, yeah, like there's got to be some sort of like apolitical way to bring about human freedom. But I think the real like thing we need to address right now is the fact that our way of life is like incredibly self-destructive, and we're kind of ruining any possibility of a future for the human race if we don't change like our economic structure. Because yeah, I don't want to choke on smog and die. That sounds shitty. And I think the only way to change that isn't really through poetry, but like through actively healing like parts of the earth we've damaged.
Do you find York and specifically the, I guess your colleagues and students, because this is a master's program, do you find them a little bit slow on the action side of things, or?
Well, grad school takes a lot of your time. And like, I'm shit on the action things too. Like, I've only been to one solidarity protest for the Wet'suwet'en, even though there's been several near me. And I don't know. I like even someone who's like, I don't know, sees it as kind of an obligation to show support. Even I miss shit and fuck up. So like, I don't blame them for not being incredibly active, because like the system is set up to make it challenging, and it's not easy work. But well, like early on, I was talking to someone in my cohort, and they said something that like struck me really the wrong way. I was telling them about like volunteering for the NDP candidate in the area and wanting to like maybe potentially find a career in like politics in that sense. And they just said, huh, there is no politics. And I was like, no, like, don't, right? And I think he just means like, oh, don't believe any of these like lies from these parties. Don't believe in any emancipatory project. Really, like, there's no politics. There's no hope in that sense. We don't have that kind of like controller agency or something. I don't know. It struck me the wrong way, because they're also a political person. Like they share shit on Facebook or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. It's what I don't like is people in the academy who don't believe in anything. Like, especially because my program's heavy in critical theory and things like deconstruction, which once you learn are very helpful tools for dismantling texts and understanding the biases and the inconsistencies. But if all you can do is critique, it's kind of impotent, and it just kind of traps itself in a circle, just like almost like cannibalistically, just like picking things apart, but never actually putting anything forward that could help us move to like a more just kind of relation to each other. And I find it just sucks to be in a class discussion where you're talking about something really exciting, like nonviolent militants and like to what extent it's justified to resist the state. And then people are just like picking at inconsistencies in this text that someone wrote in 1920. And you're like, yeah, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. He didn't adequately address fascism because it was 1920. Yep, no, the Nazis hadn't happened yet, but okay, I see your point. You could co-opt it, sure, but like when we could be talking, I don't know, more positively about what we need to do, because we do need to do something different, or at least that's how I feel.
What do you think, or what do you feel about the role of the public intellectual? Do you know what I mean by that? Like the kind of thing that Noam Chomsky does, where he's, you know, renowned academic, but uses that power to be someone who serves politics in a non-elected capacity.
I think the like the non-elected capacity is important for the public intellectual in a way. Like, I don't know, it's to be a thought leader, but still outside of the systems of power, I think gives a public intellectual a kind of credibility. Like, I don't know, like there's a difference between a public intellectual and someone like Bill Nye, for say, who's famous for like, I don't know, for the media he's produced. And well, I don't know if Bill Nye's the right answer, the right comparison to make there. So I don't know if I will, but
he's
like
become somewhat political in the last few years around climate stuff.
I don't really want to shit talk him. I just want to say that like by being kind of like so intimately connected to capitalism, he loses some kind of credibility.
Right.
Yeah, he's like more of a product than like a scholar. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not like his career is based around criticizing the system. It's educating.
Yeah.
Science is cool.
Right. In fun ways. And
yeah.
And honestly, like, I don't even want to say that being a scholar or fucking going to some fancy institution legitimizes you as an intellectual. I do think intellectuals, like in an almost Nietzschean sense, need to be like speaking in an untimely way, like in a way that kind of rubs against the grain of existing society. And if you aren't kind of like, yeah, if you aren't positing something new, I don't know if you can like gain some kind of credibility. If you're just sort of like parroting things that have been believed for like a very long time, maybe not. I don't know. I keep on like, yeah, second guessing what I say about this. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I think we always have to recognize that public intellectuals come from a context. Like, it's not just like an individual act of will. It's vast networks of people and texts that have informed them and guided them to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think an ideal example of a public intellectual might be someone like Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Like, in the sense of he had a doctorate, he was like a renowned scholar, but then took this kind of like his immense ability with rhetoric to the streets and just like packaged these very important ideas of justice in this Christian language that was just, it just hit to the root of the American consciousness. So maybe that's what I think the role of the public intellectual is to do, is to take like serious critical study and like very rigorous ideas and then package them for public consumption in a way that just culturally resonates.
How do you make that happen? Because there seems to be something of a disconnect between the ivory tower and the mailroom, if you will. No, the average Joe blue collar people who are, at least in a system where education is so expensive, it's very inaccessible, and some people distrust, you know, so-called intellectuals for those kinds of reasons. How do you bridge that gap?
Shared culture in a way, especially pop culture, like things that seem sort of maybe mundane or lowbrow in a way, but kind of resonate with everyone. I don't know. It's a very complex question, because I don't think people necessarily should have trust in elite or like the people society has appointed as the ones who have the truth. Like, that's exactly what people should always be questioning. And an honest public intellectual should be trying to give people the tools to question the seat of power and the seat of authority and what constitutes knowledge. And I think the only way to get to them is to produce cultural forms that resonate like throughout the entire consciousness of the people you're trying to reach. And it's always going to be very contextual. Like, yeah, the bridging of that gap in Canada will look different than the bridging of that gap in Mexico. It'll look different than the bridging of that gap in Britain. Like, there's going to be different cultural forms that'll arise there, and different artists, I guess, that are producing it. I don't know. It's a complex question. I think the key is articulating common ground in terms that are understood by both parties. I think a lot of the distrust of intellectuals comes from like jargon heavy, kind of like paternal sort of bullshit, where it's like prescribing this sort of just like, I've divined the answer, and you dumb pleb, this is what you should be doing if you were smart enough to know, like that sort of like separation. Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I find quite off-putting about academic like Marxism, because it is so jargon heavy when it's supposed to be for the proletariat, which are the working class who don't read, you know, Lacan and Zizek and stuff like that. You know, they don't.
Hell, they don't even read Lenin. Like, fuck.
Yeah.
Right.
So how do you, you know, like, how do you make pamphlets? I guess that's not a good question, but you know what I mean?
You make YouTube videos.
Yeah.
You make fucking TikToks that just right. Very quickly and concisely point out basic class analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I really think you do. It's got to be funny, and it's got to be fast. And it's got to be just like hard hitting and quick.
That's the case with all media these days, I'd say.
Yeah. And all media is different now. It's not the age of the fucking printing press. It's the age of the fucking 5-second just like neuron blast.
Yeah.
That people get thousands of every day.
That's something we discuss in our classes here regularly, actually.
How do you do journalism in this fucking like rapid kind of climate?
Not easily, where it's better to be first than it is to be right. Like,
word.
That's messed up.
Oh, and also fuck the algorithm. Jesus Christ, fuck the algorithm. Like, dividing and polarizing people, making no one know what news is real, all to the end of Capital, I hate it. Fucking hate it.
Have you ever seen anything about how the YouTube algorithm works?
I've heard some, like, honestly kind of hilarious horror stories
about
children's videos that are produced by an algorithm, just mixing together different video forms, slowly mixing with like the bad parts of YouTube or whatever, and producing these monstrosities, which are then through autoplay just thrown into what is assumed to be like child content. And also, oh my God, like, have you ever noticed that when you go on YouTube and type in something very simple, like, I don't know, how do borders work or something, you'll get like 8 very far right suggestions that are like, borders do not work because there should be a man with a big ass sword there who just like kills everyone. And like, it's disturbing how hesitant YouTube is to deplatform right wing thinkers. And it's also even more disturbing that their algorithm seems to just direct people into this radicalization pipeline just because they watched one PewDiePie video. It's fucked up. And it's all because it's what's profitable, which is even more fucked up. It's like, have a source of value that actually exists in life, not just like a little number.
So why, and you are heading off towards a PhD next?
Hopefully. Yeah, I don't know yet.
Wow, you'll.
I also got to succeed with the masters. They don't let you just like skip, hop, and jump in. You got to finish.
Right. Why academia? Why do you want to pursue this path that, at least in my case, when I was interested in it, I had so many teachers tell me not to?
Same here. And I fucking did not want to do this. Like, in all honesty, this is the one school I applied to because they had a very reasonable funding package. And I thought I could just smoke weed all the time and read cool books. And that has very clearly been proven true. It's interdisciplinary, independent study. I develop my own research. I choose the texts I want. And I have an amazing amount of free time to just study whatever I want and also smoke weed. And it's that freedom is amazing. It's like the best part of King's, my undergrad school, but just more serious, and I get paid to do it, which is amazing. But it was the one place I applied to, and I was honestly immensely depressed all summer because it took a very long time for them to make a decision on my application. And I was like, Jesus, I've spent all this time and all this energy getting a degree that like no one really gives a fuck about. I've made like this thesis, but I can't explain it to anyone. So what's the fucking point? What do I do? Oh, also, like, the world's collapsing. Shit, I gotta find something to do. But then I got in, and because I had nothing, I had no other prospect. Like, I'd been working as a bartender, but like, that's not really a prospect. It's just something to do. And then I got into this school and I thought, fuck it, I'll move to Toronto. That sounds cool. There's stuff there. And now I'm in a cool band. So like, I guess it worked out. And the only reason I applied to the PhD is because like everyone I've talked to who's been in the adult workforce, like a lot of people that I'm friends with at school are like a couple years older than me. And they spent some years in an office environment before moving like back to academia. And they said, no, it just sucks out there. It honestly sucks out there. Like, answering emails and like having to deal with corporate hierarchy is shit. And I just want a place where they'll pay me to read. Like, I think that's, at the end of the day, that's really what it comes down to. It's the only place on earth I've found that'll pay you just to read.
Yeah.
Academia 2020. Oh, but it's also turning into a neoliberal degree mill. So dark and spooky times. And for the PhD, I actually have to start working for them and teaching classes. So, oh boy.
You've done a little bit of that though, right?
No, I haven't. My master's program, because it's a 1-year one, you don't get any TA or GA positions.
Oh, I thought you were doing a little bit of seminar leading.
No, I will be in the PhD, but no, not this time around.
Okay.
Which is honestly like good for me. I like it. Very luxurious schedule.
Are you looking forward to doing teaching though?
I honestly am. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the fuck the Zoomers are up to. Like, I was born right on the cusp between Millennial and Zoomer, and the Zoomers are where all our hope has to lie. So I'm curious what the fuck's going on. I'm curious if I can even connect to them. I'm curious what it's like to be the one leading the tutorial. That'll be mind-bending because I've only ever been the person like taking the tutorial. Being fucking like Professor Dan strutting in, I don't know. Like, it's a weird fucking world, and I'm curious to get a taste of it.
Just before moving on to some current events kind of stuff, can you give a quick rundown of what you hope to write your PhD on with as little of the aforementioned jargon as possible so I don't have to unpack all of it?
Yeah, yo, I can, truth be told, I'm still even pinning down my master's project, so I don't, like, have an exact thesis statement for you, but I do have the, like, question or the kind of feeling that sort of drives it.
Sure.
And that's a feeling that, as the modern world emerged and as the world was globalized through the emergence of modern technology, it was set up in such a way as to force a certain perspective and only one sort of path. Everything kind of gets ordered into a chain, and the point of this technological chain is only to produce itself. And that has run into an immense amount of problems because it is currently destroying the environment, this self-producing chain. And more importantly, it's denied agency from people. I think we see that a lot now in the sense of how much the algorithm controls the content we have access to and the thoughts that are even in our head. And modern technology, yeah, it's not only is it destroying the world, it's destroying human agency. And this coincides with what Nietzsche calls the death of God. Like that loss of any centralized value, but also kind of the erasure of any sort of mystery or sacredness to life. Everything becomes meaningless, but we still keep doing the same thing. Nothing really changes, even though it's meaningless. And that's kind of what makes it meaningless. And honestly, like so many thinkers on the left, and not even just the left, but they're trying to defeat this by restoring a secular sense of the sacred, a sense of divinity that doesn't require some sort of like written word testament or some sort of absolute truth, just something that exists in life that can be considered a high source of value and something that can restore meaning to life and give us something to reframe our political systems around. So it's not just about the proliferation of bigger and bigger technology. And I think this sense of the sacred can be found in the sense that we all share a body, that the environment, the ecosystem is a unified kind of whole that just operates in cycles of flows that feed into each other. And it's something we all share. And I don't know, we feel like individuals, but that's just mental. That's just our conscious cognition. The unconscious part of us, our bodies, our hearts, the air we breathe, the food we eat, that connects us to everything around us. And I think we can take this sense of unity and make it the new foundation for an ethical system in the wake of the death of God. And hopefully in this way address the climate crisis, please.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, I know that was not very few words, but
it's a PhD thesis. It's going to be a bunch of words.
I don't know. I've got an even shorter way of framing it.
I guess they call them a dissertation when you do that, but
right?
Yeah,
that's true.
Go ahead.
That's true. Yo, the even shorter way. Nietzsche, death of God. Oh shit, he actually has a God. He believes in Dionysus, the overturner of values, the great disruptor, the force of the universe that is death as life itself. This is cool as fuck, but it leads to fascism, even though it's cool as fuck. But when you try to pray to that as your God, it leads to fascism. It's bullshit. What you actually need to pray to is Gaia, the earth, the thing that you actually are. You need to focus on your body, not just overcoming it and transcending as the Übermensch. You got to focus on what you are and what you have obligations to.
Any mention of Spinoza in this?
Oh, he's always in the background in my heart. there's actually a
You're
guy
talking about
in
his
my Natura? Cohort. Yo, you'd love this. There's a guy in my cohort who's talking about Spinoza as a critique of Carl Schmitt and the friend-enemy distinction that he bases his politics on.
Interesting.
And basically saying that that distinction can be overcome by Spinoza's ethics, which is cool shit. I think you'd appreciate him. His name is Colin, and he started his master's 10 years ago, then went to work as a lawyer for a bit, and then came back. Not as a lawyer, sorry, as a legal assistant, but either way, he was basically being a radical activist and working with the legal system the whole time. And then he was like, yeah, I'll come back and finish that cool thing, which I respect.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
My pleasure, yo. My pleasure.
While the end of each OJT episode is normally dedicated to the progress report, this week I'm bringing you, listeners, the pandemic report. So far, I've mostly avoided talking about COVID-19 for one reason. It's boring. So boring, in fact, that until recently, it had stamped out much of my journalistic vigor. In the winter, I was frustrated when the news became all about coronavirus because I was adamant there was more going on in the world. And there was more going on. Until there wasn't. When Holland College shut down in late March, I was inspired to cover COVID from different angles and be on top of perhaps the most important news story in my lifetime. Then the weeks dragged on, and I found myself writing the same story. This one, in fact. The story of, where were you when you realized nothing would ever be the same? It got boring fast. So I enrolled in a couple online condensed science courses to work on my university degree. While I've been getting a lot out of physiology, it hasn't done much to turn me back onto journalism. Between these things, I haven't interviewed anyone for the podcast in months. I was given very sound advice to not launch until I had at least half dozen recorded and edited episodes in the tank, ready to go, in case something went wrong. Like I said, sound advice. Which brings me to why Daniel Platz was back today, and why both he and Jack Vandenbroek will be in later episodes. My original interviews with each of them were long and touched on a range of topics. When I got to the editing for both, I found several episodes worth of material. So, while I'm hoping to get back out there as soon as my course finishes on June 25th, I may still have to rely on that back catalog for another episode or two. Finally, so I don't leave you with the wrong impression, I want to add that my journalistic fire has been completely relighted by recent events. Overnight, it seems, I've gone from shopping for blue, sterile gloves and N95s to looking for tactical gloves and a gas mask. And that will do it for this week's OJT. You can follow Daniel Platz and Discontinuity on Instagram at dis.continuity, and you can like their page on Facebook. Their debut EP, Disc 1, is available on everything from Spotify to Napster. Daniel himself is on Twitter at Hegelian Outhouse under the name Droptop Romanov. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at OJT_podcast and on Twitter at OJTpodcast. The Facebook page is OJT on the job training. You can follow me on Instagram at Logan.McLean.75 and on Twitter at LoganMcLean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, OJTpod.ca, for more pictures and content from Daniel and Discontinuity, along with my written stories and photography and pages on past guests and episodes. The podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground. And if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT on the job training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.